You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Asha Senecker. I'm sorry, I mispronounced that. I will get it right sooner or later. part of it is just working through. Asha, it's good to have you on the show this morning.
Thank you so
much. Thank you for being willing to come on and join us. What do we, the show starts with the question, who are you? And you take that as broadly, but where do we need to start the conversation? You know, labels, experiences, qualities of life that you aspire to. Let me know, who are you, for to start our conversation?
That's a big question, isn't it? I would say currently, who I am is I'm a single mom of two girls who are almost 9 and 13. I am the general manager of Buffalo Street Books here in downtown Ithaca. I'm a resident of the city of Ithaca. And I'm a Quaker and a political activist. And I think that's all the major aspects of life right now.
And we'll... we'll weave from that and back to earlier stuff, and as the course of our conversation goes on. You brought some music with you.
I did, indeed.
What would you like to start with?
I really thought long and hard about the music because my whole life has been about music. My dad's dad was a church choir director and a music professor. That was his work. And my dad grew up in his choirs from the time that he could walk. And so I started singing in choirs in third grade and sang in choirs until I was finished in college. But I also grew up in Washington, D.C., and not in the D.C. metropolitan area, but in D.C.
In which part?
Northwest, right near the old Walter Reed Army Hospital, down the street from Howard University. And so I grew up in an environment, you know, in the 70s and 80s where I actually found out just recently that D.C. for the first time ever in their census was no longer a majority African-American city, which certainly wasn't the case when I was growing up. They didn't call it Chocolate City for nothing. And so I grew up in an environment where I was in the minority. And so I included this song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, because it's considered the Negro National Anthem. And it's actually, I knew this song by heart before I knew the U.S. National Anthem.
Wow.
Because that's the environment I grew up
in.
You know, D.C. is a you know, stronghold of the black middle class historically. And that's the environment I grew up in. And so this piece both embodies so much of the sort of power of communal voice that's such a huge part of my life, but also embodies that piece of my history.
Well, let's listen to it.
Steady breath of our way.
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. I'm Eric Clay, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Asha Saneker. So, Asha, you already started telling about your kind of your early formative events with the choir and your grandfather and father, mm-hmm. and how this was the song that you learned before you learned the national anthem. So you were in D.C. in the 70s and the 80s,
yep.
and that was after the riots. It did a lot of
indeed,
you know, a lot of stuff. Where did you go from that beginning? What were your next steps?
Well, let's see. Let me back up for a second and say the reason that my parents were in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, in the early days of the draft of the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. Opted, rather than taking what would have been a pastoral deferment,
mm-hmm.
Because he was scheduled to go to seminary, he opted to do alternative service, which was what possible at that point.
Right.
And so he and my mom ended up in rural Tanzania in like 1963,
wow.
doing development work as my dad's alternative service. And they were, as far as they knew, never going to be able to have their own children. And so they met my oldest brother, Paul, when he was about a year old, mm-hmm. and finally came to adopt him when he was three. He had been living with his grandmother, and she died, and he didn't have anywhere to go, and my parents had fallen in love with him. So, and then they arranged for the adoption of my older brother, David, who is also black, in the States, mm-hmm. came back for a summer to visit my grandparents in California, signed the adoption papers, and took him back to Africa with them. So,
wow, that's a whirlwind on
yeah,
all sorts of levels.
Exactly. And so when they came back to the States, they had, you know, they had two kids. They mm-hmm. had been married for 10 years. They were sort of ready to go with their happy 70s multicultural family.
Sure.
And then my mom found out she was pregnant. And nobody was prepared for that. And so my parents moved to D.C. because, one, on a practical level, my dad got a job as a lobbyist for the Quaker lobbying group, Friends Committee mm-hmm. for National mm-hmm. Legislation, but also because they wanted to be in an environment where my siblings would have community and be part of, you know, a preponderance of people that looked like them and were like
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some ways that was successful. In some ways it wasn't so successful because, right. of course, my parents are Quakers. And so the Quaker community is very white. It's
yeah.
very white, and it's very middle class, and it's very intellectual, and it's very conflict avoidant, to be perfectly frank.
Right, you could even
and,
be more blunt.
yeah. And that was my parents' whole life,
right.
privately. And then we were growing up in an environment that was everything that an urban environment can be. It was
right.
chaotic and full of conflict, and also had a lot of beauty to it. But, you know, my parents were working very hard to create a kind of private utopia.
Uh-huh.
You know, where like if we just apply enough love, then nothing else matters because we can conquer racism and we can conquer everything by just loving each other.
And finding without that of God in everyone.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The Quakers.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they didn't really deal very well with the ways that the racism that our lives were steeped inside of course, infected us mm-hmm. and infected our interactions with each other.
Right.
And none of that ever really got dealt with. And so my home life growing up was very, very chaotic. There was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of physical violence.
Mm-hmm.
My older brother David was physically and sexually abusive to me for about 10 years when I was growing up, starting when I was about 3 and a half. And no one was dealing with it.
Right.
And so I went to college in Indiana, to Quaker School, Earlham College. Okay. And then I started sort of dealing with all of that mm-hmm. once I was out of the house and could actually deal with it. And it became really clear to me that, like, I could never go home. So I moved immediately after college. I have kids, so after school has a different connotation for me now. Yeah. After college to Seattle, Washington, there uh-huh. was a year of service internship through the Quaker meeting there mm-hmm. that would provide me with job and health insurance and a place to live for a year, and I could, you know, get out. So I, and at the time, of course, you know, at whatever it was, 22, mm-hmm. you know, I was not as conscious as I am now of the extent to which I was running away.
Right.
I was getting as far as I possibly could from home while still staying in the contiguous United States.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. So I lived in Seattle for about 7 years, mm-hmm. and I was a social worker there primarily. I worked in confidential domestic violence shelters and with chronically homeless women in downtown Seattle. For a while towards the end there, I was a community advocate in domestic violence program, domestic violence program, and my clients were primarily what were known as victim offenders in the King County Jail. So at that time in Washington State, domestic violence was a mandatory felony arrest, mm-hmm. But it was also a three strikes, you're out state. So if you got three felonies, you could end up in jail for life.
Yeah.
And so abusers would call the police and then manipulate the situation so that their victims were the one getting arrested.
Yeah.
And then if they got arrested enough times, then they could hold it over their head and say, yeah, call the police one more time. Go right ahead. And then you will sit in jail for the rest of your life.
Right.
So I was working with those women in the King County Jail.
It sounds like you went from one trauma to another.
Yeah, I did.
And was college an interlude, or was that just kind of an awareness of the trauma?
College was, I majored in African and African American studies. Mm-hmm. In college, and I spent some time in East Africa for mm-hmm. the first time, because my parents, of course, came back from Tanzania when my mom was pregnant.
And you'd probably
never been there.
Myth of it.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. And also because I grew up in D.C., there were embassy houses in our neighborhood, and my mom was doing ESL with the students of those families, and so there were Africans speaking Swahili in and out of our home all the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, I assumed that when I got to East Africa, it would be like coming home on some level mm-hmm. because it had clearly been such a hard home for my parents.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it wasn't at all. I mean, I was in Kenya, and Kenya and Tanzania are very different countries mm-hmm. in terms of their colonial history
right.
and their modern experience mm-hmm. of government and society. But also, you know, it was just a different time. It was 20 years later, you know,
mm-hmm.
and,
sure.
And so, you know, I was starting to sort of step away, but also trying to parse out where I came from, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, having been raised by Quakers, I was raised to, you know, to work for justice.
Right.
And so learning about protest history and learning about the history of the civil rights movement and learning about the history of the fight against colonialism in Africa, you know, it really resonated mm-hmm. for me. It was very important.
And it parallels kind of your own framing of your story about becoming aware of the injustice of that you'd lived through and acting on it for your own benefit to get to Washington, even though it was running. No?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it always makes me think of Rachel Dolezal, who I assume you know who that is, the woman who pretended that she was black and then was exposed in Spokane, Washington. And watching that whole thing play out was so interesting for me mm-hmm. in a way that was, I think, different than some people because there were so many parallels in our life experience. Mm-hmm. You know, she had siblings who were adopted who were African American. She had a degree in African and African American studies. She had been in an abusive marriage. You know, like there were so many ways in which we lined up. And so it was like looking at myself through a funhouse mirror, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, because I could both understand how she made the choice that she did. Mm-hmm. You know, if you, despite your privilege, which you, I don't think ever can deny,
right.
If in your private life you are being victimized and you feel so lacking in power that the idea of your own privilege doesn't even connect, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, like you really don't feel powerful right. at all because of these other things right. that are happening to you. And what you want is to feel powerful. And there is no group of people in this country that are potentially more powerful than Black women. They have survived and endured and triumphed and developed their own defiant and exquisite beauty in the mm-hmm. face of so much oppression. And like, I can understand, though I do not agree with it, the desire to claim that in order to claim some feeling of power. And so, you know, I feel like what she did was wrong, but I get that piece, and that has been a piece of my own history and my own life that I've had to figure out how to embody, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. How do I both move through the world as a white woman with all of the privilege that that contains and take responsibility for the implications of that privilege and push against systems that institutionalize that privilege. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And at the same time, carry within me the feeling, you know, when I watch the Ferguson, you know, protests and when I watch people dying on YouTube because they're being brutalized by the police, for me that's my family, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, like and yeah. like not in a universal human we're all no, family way, but in a very visceral family. That's my family, yeah. and that's so hard to carry and to figure out how to live mm-hmm. with and how to use and transform into something that can change the world.
So what are you thinking about? And I'm when you are caught in the grinding of those gears mm-hmm. about your identities and solidarities, as well as the fact of privilege and your other identities, mm-hmm. How do you think? What do you think you can do? I mean, what is possible?
Hmm. Well, interestingly enough, it seems very mundane, but so my job is as the general manager of an independent bookstore. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the thing about that, beyond it just paying my bills, and that's great, that is really meaningful to me, is that I believe that stories and the power of stories is how we transform our own individual pain potentially into something that changes the world. Mm-hmm. Someone said to me once when my oldest daughter was 10 or 11 and she was starting to want to read all of these, like, you know, middle reader sort of horror books. Mm-hmm. And I've never really been interested in that sort of stuff. And so I didn't really understand it. And she said to me, you know, children at this age are often drawn to these kinds of stories because they are being confronted for the first time, because they are becoming more complicated people, with their own darkness and with the darkness of the world. And so by reading these stories, they can interact with darkness outside of themselves.
Right.
And they can puzzle over it, and they can grapple with it, and they can think about it. And then slowly but surely, they can start figuring out how it reflects or resonates their own internal experience or their experience of the world, and it allows them to process it. And I feel like that's true of books and stories generally. You know, the experience of being human can be so painful. And I really do believe that the vast majority of the pain that we inflict on other people for whatever, you know, their identities or the, you know, surface details of that situation is because we do not know how to hold and honor and process our own pain. We are not taught that in this culture. And I believe that one of the beauties of books and stories is that it allows us to interact with someone else's experience, potentially someone else's deep pain, and therefore sort of get some distance from our own stuff so that then we can look at it and really start to process it so that we don't have to inflict it on other people.
Right. And to recognize that part of being human is both healing and hurting self and others.
Exactly. I mean,
and kind of to in a way, it becomes less extreme when it's more normal. It's one way of interpreting. When you've accepted that those both of those qualities exist in you, and you will from time to time act on both of them, whether you're proud of it or not, the knowledge will tend to restrain the damage and emphasize the better part, but it will not eliminate.
Exactly. Them.
And that's a very, very important lesson, right? Painful lesson.
Yeah.
To learn.
Yeah.
I want to cut to music. What should we what should we play next?
Oh. Can we play the Mahalia Jackson?
Sure. And it's Take My Hand, Precious Lord.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on. Let me stand linger.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host. And our guest on this hour is Asha Saneker. Asha, tell me about that song.
That song has been my favorite song in the whole world. The singer in that particular rendition was the great gospel singer Mahalia Jackson for as long as I can remember. And when my father died in the fall of 2014, somewhat unexpectedly, and I got the call from my mom that, you know, he was in the hospital, mm-hmm. and we better come. And, you know, in a half an hour, I was in the car with my two kids leaving Ithaca at 6 o'clock in the evening and driving hellbent for leather to DC to make it to the hospital before he was gone. Yeah. And, you know, as I said before, my dad grew up in the church and he grew up with church music. And though I do not consider myself a Christian at this point in my mm-hmm. life, church music moves me. I grew mm-hmm. up with church music, and the peace in particularly gospel music and spirituals about how painful life is and where you put that, where you know, ultimately the only place to take that is to God,
mm-hmm.
Is very potent for me. And so I sang that song over and over and over again in the car because I don't have a working CD player and the radio was bad between here and DC.
Yep.
And so I just sang that song over and over and over again while my kids slept in the back seat, and then, you know, ran into the hospital and marched into my dad's room, and he was functionally gone. You know, he had had a massive heart attack and they were keeping him alive, you know, with drugs and life support.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went straight to him and leaned over him and sang him that song and said to him, "You know what, Dad? You and I both know that you have made a lot of mistakes in your life. But one of the things that you learn when you are in theater, like I have been on and off my whole life, is that if you end strong, they'll forgive you everything." You know, and literally the week before my father died, he and my mom had chosen to cash in all the equity in their house in DC and buy a house for my girls and I to live in here in Ithaca, because my divorce had not concluded and I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, "You know what, we'll take care of it. And then when you're done with your divorce, you can buy it from us, but we just want you and the girls to be safe and happy."
Right.
And I was like, you have guaranteed, Dad, that the girls and I have a home. And you could not have done more for us to take care of us at this time in our lives. And so it's okay. It's all okay. You can go, Dad. You know, and he was gone like 6 hours later.
Wow.
You know, so it's also, you know, it's funny because after my grandparents died, my dad's parents, his sort of way of perhaps beginning to carry them in himself mm-hmm. more effectively because they weren't outside of him anymore.
Sure.
Was that he sort of rediscovered much of his Christianity mm-hmm. and really sort of that became a much more ardent thing for him. And one of the ways that I have begun to carry my father inside of myself, you know, subsequent to his death, was that I have come back to singing church music. Mm-hmm. So I'm now an enthusiastic member of the Dorothy Cotton Jubilee Singers, mm-hmm. a local choir that specializes in spirituals and gospel. And it is the most joyful experience of my life
yep.
to sing with them. And I feel like when I do that, my father is with me, you know. And here we are on Father's Day, and on Mother's Day, we had a huge concert at a church downtown, and I got a chance to stand up in front of all of those people and sing for myself, but also for him, because whenever I sing, I feel like it's for him.
Mm-hmm. You blessed him in his passing, and he blessed you.
He did.
That doesn't change the past, but it allows us to move on when yeah. we do those kinds of things. And were you able to do more of the stereotypic processing of your pain with your father, or was he able more to just show his regard for you in later years?
Yeah, no. Yeah. My dad was a child of his generation.
Yeah.
He was a tremendous human being and absolutely horrible at the same time. Mm-hmm. And he was a man who was in tremendous pain and completely disconnected from any capacity to process that.
Yeah.
You know, and I loved my dad and I don't miss him at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of my process in my life is to figure out how to hold the complexity of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. When I grew up in kind of rough circumstances, but I never missed my mom after she died. And it was like 4 or 5 years later that I finally had some of that sense. And it surprised me. But I still don't much, but every once in a while. And I think you must have done the work beforehand, because that's, for me, that's what it was really yeah. important for me to do the work on myself before she died, so that yeah. when she died, then it would be, you know, done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, in order to continue to have a relationship with both my parents, mm-hmm. I have had to accept that they can only be who they are,
mm-hmm. yep.
you know, and also becoming a parent myself, really understanding that, as children, in many ways, we can only experience our parents as who they are to us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But who they are is much more vast and complicated than that.
Yes, we're not because, the thing that defines their whole lives.
Exactly.
Yes, yes.
Because my children's experience of me is very particular. And, you know, I had 30 years of life before they mm-hmm. came onto mm-hmm. the scene, yep. you know. And I have an entire life that exists separate from them and an entire self. And so, you know, I don't get to say who my parents are. I only get to allow them to be right. whoever they are, take whatever I can mm-hmm. constructively from my relationship with them, and then move on
yeah.
in my own life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're moving into what I wanted to ask about. How has your relationship with your two daughters, right, changed based? I mean, how has your experience of being a daughter and growing up and coming to terms with what you didn't necessarily knew you had to come to terms with? How is that changing the way you're parenting your daughters?
You know, there are things that we can do for our children that we can't necessarily do for ourselves. And for my children, I have become an incredible warrior. I am fiercely protective of my children, not in a, like, I keep them from having experiences in the world way,
right,
but I am mindful of the darkness. And I have worked very hard to really develop a relationship with my children where we can have real and substantive conversations about the world. And I can sort of take the courageous step to acknowledge to them that the world is complicated, and they have complicated feelings about it, and they're going to encounter complicated and potentially painful things in the world and in themselves. And like, let's talk about that. Let's deal with that. Cause that's the thing that I didn't get growing up.
Right.
You know, there was all kinds of chaos, but no one was talking about it.
Right. This is awful, which means both full of wonder and awe and full of terror and horror.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and so I am very, very intentional about the way that I parent my girls. And I also have slowly but surely developed a capacity to reach for my own joy, because that's something that's really hard for me, for my own self, but I do it for them because I want them to believe that they deserve to reach for their own joy.
Right. Right. And even if you don't necessarily believe that you deserve it, you can do it because they need to see you do it.
Exactly.
Been there, done
and
that.
And sometimes it's like fake it till you make it kind of thing.
Yep. yeah,
and so, you know, I find myself to be more joyful now than I have ever been in the entire history of my life. And in some ways it is because I have forced myself to do that even when I didn't feel it. I didn't know how to do it. I wasn't raised to that. But I have started to claim that for myself, for them, and it has fortunately reverberated back inside.
Right. And what I hear in your story, and I've never thought about it quite this way before, but you have the discipline of honesty about what is wonder-filled and what is horrifying about life. You're having that with your kids. The fear that you grew up with and the suffering or the brokenness that you experienced, that creates a foundation for joy that is every bit as large as the suffering that preceded it. But it's hard to get there.
Yeah.
But you have created this spectrum of space, or at least as you describe it with your children, that opens the door for yourself to dance out in a different way. And that's very powerful.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing world. It truly is. And it is full of ecstasy and horror.
I get pushback from people when we talk about this because they want to protect their children from, which is not what you want to do. Your warrior is more like an advocate who's there along their side, but not to change the experience they have.
Right.
And sometimes we will be our children's own worst enemies as well as their best advocates. And that kind of realism is, we could use a lot more of it.
Well, you know, it has allowed my children to develop into remarkably thoughtful and astute human beings. And they also are, you know, to be perfectly honest, less broken than I am. And so they're much more forgiving and patient about other people's mistakes and calamities than I am.
And probably much more forgiving of their own and less quick to shut themselves down. From what you're, I would infer that, but I may
be wrong. I think so. We're working on that.
Yeah.
You know, my divorce was pretty hard for them.
Yeah.
And that was, that took a lot of time and attention. But, you know, I feel like we're all on the other side of that now. And it has, and because I didn't, like my parents, sort of shuffle it all under the rug and be like, okay, so here's what we're going to do so we don't have to deal with the mess of this.
Right.
We're going to, you know, focus on what
we're going to focus on what's
do.
Coming next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I really sat with them and tried to support them in having whatever their process was going to be about it. They have become more compassionate and deeper human beings, because I was like, yeah, this is painful. This is incredibly painful. So how are we going to create space for that? How are we going to hold that together until it isn't so painful anymore? Right.
And how are we going to hold each other in a way that doesn't put salt in our wounds, but allows us to touch those very painful spaces?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. What music should we go to next?
Oh, I would say let's go to the Janis.
And it's Janis Joplin's recording of Summertime.
Rise up singing. you're gonna spread your wings, child, and take to the sky. To harm you now. Na 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 na. Don't you cry.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Asha Saneker. Asha, we got about 10 minutes or so in the show, and some of that will be with your last song, but the way I like to close the show is to ask people, what do you do to restore yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically, spiritually? And what do you, and when do you know you need to do that? How do you do this on a daily, weekly, monthly, regular basis? What do you do to take care and try to recalibrate or recenter yourself, if that is the right language for you? But pick your language. Let me know.
I think there are a bunch of different things. I am currently a regular attender at the Quaker meeting here in Ithaca. It took me a long time to get back to Quaker meeting. I left Quakerism in my 20s in some frustration and disgust.
And most people leave their religion of origin sometime between 15 and 25. I mean, it's
And mine was very palpably around this question of pacifism, and really coming in my 20s up against the idea that I didn't know that I could say that I was a pacifist, and I needed help and support in figuring out how to hold and process and transform my rage. And I couldn't at that point in my life find anyone in the Quaker community who could sit with that, and so I had to leave because that wasn't helping. You know, time marches on, and I.
So, what did you discover about your rage, or how to? Did you find somebody to grow against?
I went to a lot of therapy, and have over the course of my life, which I really believe in, and that's one of the other things that I do for myself is that I go to therapy, and I, you know, prioritize having a space to say all of the things that I don't want to necessarily say to anyone else, so that I can then hold them outside of myself and look at them and parse out whether or not they're actually true. Right. I also started writing, and I write a lot. And that allowed me to process a lot of stuff. But I also just came to the realization. Originally, I mean, I think like many people, I went back to Quaker meeting because my children became old enough to start to participate in some sort of Quaker programming. And I felt like it was time, like that I wasn't giving them one of the things that I had gotten as a kid, which was a really strong spiritual foundation in my life. And so I needed to do that for them. And then, of course, you know, as is obviously the case, I do things for my children, and then I find that they actually, you know, are meaningful and important for me as well. And the, you know, one of the things my mom used to say to me, unlike many of my peers growing up, who once they hit like junior high school, high school, their parents stopped making them go to Quaker meeting. My mom was unrelenting in her insistence that as long as I lived in her house, she didn't care how late I'd been out or where I'd been or what I thought I was going to be doing on Sunday morning. She was at the foot of my bed, getting me up, telling me to put my shoes on. In this house on Sunday morning, we go to Quaker meeting. And I'd be like, Mom, nobody else is there. Why do I have to go? And she said, you know what? There's a thing called spiritual discipline. And the point of Quaker meeting is to sit in expectant waiting for the voice of God. And God doesn't just show up because you decided to show up one day. God shows up when God wants to show up. And if you don't show up, then you're going to miss it. So your job and your only job is to show up. And if you're lucky and you keep showing up, then God will speak to you. And, you know, I think that's true creatively in our lives. I think that's true spiritually. I think that's true in relationships,
right.
You know,
yeah.
that act of showing up is really potent. And so that's what I do now. I show up.
Right. And it's not just about what happens Sunday morning. It's a metaphor for every morning when you wake up, you show up.
Exactly.
Fully present and accounted for.
Exactly.
And we don't often think about that kind of, it's almost etiquette.
Yeah.
Just being kind to show up so that you're with the people you're with and you're not someplace else.
Well, and I think it's also very humbling.
Yeah.
You know, like your job is very simple. You're not required to be a genius. You're not required to know. You're not required to produce anything specific.
Yep.
You are just required to provide yourself as a vehicle. You know, and that's the piece about Quakerism that I think most people don't understand is that it's actually a mystical religion.
Yeah.
You know, the whole point of Quaker meeting is theoretically that people gather in silence and expectant waiting. And if someone stands up to offer vocal ministry, they are actually speaking for God.
Right.
They are providing a channel for spirit to come into the room, and they actually have to get out of the way enough to allow that to happen. Now, I'm not saying that always happens in Quaker meeting, but that is what's supposed to be happening.
Right, and it's this, it turns on this notion where we speak of versus where we speak for. And to speak of God is something any of us can do at almost any time, but to speak for is to get completely out of the way.
Yeah.
And that's the only time when that language is not idolatrous.
Exactly.
If you hadn't thought, I mean, that's
exactly.
The way. Because any other time we are putting ourselves in a place that we ought not.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It's very powerful theology. And it's across religious traditions that kind of nuance is at play.
Exactly. And it then translates, as you say, into the entirety of the rest of your life. You know, at this moment, am I getting in the way or am I not?
Right.
You know, because my job is really to show up and then get out of the way.
I want to go back to one thing, and you're the only one of very few guests who've ever mentioned the rage that has held their lives. And rage is a stuck place. We think of people getting enraged as something that happens in the moment, but rage is really something that's been there and it's stuck there and it comes out in a certain way. Whereas anger is something that tells us something's not quite right here. There's something wrong here and I have to tend to it. You know what I mean? Because it's a reaction.
Mm.
But rage is built. It's like it's got a lot of stuff that's got to be dismantled. At least that's what I hear you're saying of it. How were you able to sort through nonviolence and rage and anger and all of these things that that get complicated and messy?
I think in some ways I had to come to a place where I admitted that I didn't have the answer and that I didn't have to.
Right.
I also had to claim the justifiable and sacred anger that was underneath the rage that had never gotten space to be fully expressed.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to claim that for myself, and I had to claim the willingness to be uncomfortable with that, and also to deal with other people's discomfort with that, because, you know, our culture does not like angry women, let's be real.
It doesn't like, but I mean, it tolerates angry men, but it doesn't like angry men either. But
that's no, I mean, I don't think we like anger generally in our culture, but angry women hold a particular place that is problematic in our culture. And so for me to finally say, you know what, actually, I get to have this. Because it's justified and it's mine, and it informs what I'm willing to fight for myself, for my children, for my community.
And it comes and it goes, but unless it comes, it cannot go away.
Yeah.
And we began this conversation with the power of Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And we've come back to that same topic as, mm-hmm. as a closing topic, because it's that experiencing of injustice and suffering that leads to both power and joy.
Mm-hmm.
And if it gets stuck in rage, it's not a good place to get stuck.
No.
If you don't know any other emotion but anger, you got a single note.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out how to transform it. I mean, that's why I chose the Janis Joplin piece because, sure. you know, I've loved Janis Joplin since I was like 10 years old. And she was clearly someone in a tremendous amount of pain
yeah.
who was working so hard to create an environment in which she could take that pain and transform it and make it exquisite. And when she got going, she could hold the pain and the ecstasy on the head of a pin, and it was just mind-blowing.
Asha, it has been wonderful to get to know you. Thanks for joining us.
It has been a great joy to do this morning.
Shall we close with Spearhead and Dream Team?
Yeah, this is an old Spearhead tune. I first heard this song when I was about 23 years old, and it embodies so much of what I love about the world.
America's anatomy, cause they're the ones who are up against the course. Our general manager is Chief Crazy Horse, and Huey Newton, cause he was extra hard. He is the one who would be playing at the shooting guard, and I can try.